This is Beverly Tomasian. I'm very excited to be presenting this program, our webcast, on ADA Standards of Care 2015. This edition of the Standards of Care is remarkably improved from previous editions. They've divided it up into 15 sections. It's a very practical document. It really speaks to advocacy and helping reach out and provide the best care to our patients possible. And as a diabetes educator and a person involved in managing diabetes care, it gives me some really good practical guidelines on where I should go, what direction I should take, and it also helps me understand if we're succeeding or not. Have we reached our targets? And so this is not only helpful for people providing diabetes education and care, but also for our patients, because we're going to be relaying this information to them and saying, these are your goals of care, and this is what we expect. And by providing this roadmap, we can really help patients prevent complications and have the best quality of life possible. I'm going to go through each of the sections. I'm going to spend more time on some sections and less on others, but that doesn't mean any one section is more or less important. But what it does mean is that we have 90 minutes. So I'm going to try and focus on the biggest changes in the next 90 minutes and also focus on, things that really affect most of our patients. So other information I'll talk about and encourage you to go ahead and read the standards in more detail. And I would have to say it's nice reading. It's not really boring or cumbersome. It's very well written. So I think you'll definitely enjoy the process. Yes, as far as where to get the PowerPoint, somebody's asking that question. I sent you an email about 15 minutes ago with a link to the PowerPoint, or also on the Diabetes Fundamentals resource page. We've been sending you links on that when you register for the course. You can click on that, and it's session 5. So there's two different ways to get the PowerPoint handouts. Let's get going. Okay, so what are the objectives for today? Review the 14 standards of care to the best of our ability in 90 minutes. That's my goal. So what I'm going to try and do is really talk about the most important aspects of the standards of care. And I'm just going to kick it off with strategy 1. Now, a lot of these sections are brand new. They've never appeared in any previous standards of care document. And they really have encapsulated in a great way all aspects of diabetes care. And look what they start with. Strategies for improving care. And so this is kind of their global approach. They're saying, how can we set up systems in our work settings and in our communities to provide the best diabetes care to our patients? And I do have a shocking statistic to tell you about. Based on a recent report by the Center for Disease Control, less than 7% of privately insured, this is privately insured adults with new diagnosed diabetes, from the year 2009 to 2012 actually joined a self-management education program, and they are insured. Their insurance companies will cover it, will cover education. And so this is probably true, we could generalize to the population as a whole. Less than 10% of people with diabetes ever receive medical nutrition therapy counseling or attend a diabetes education program. And this is really a detriment to our patients because, as you know, diabetes is primarily self-managed. So we need to provide patients and people living with diabetes with tools to self-manage their diabetes successfully. And by attending courses and by meeting with diabetes educators and dietitians, they're more able to do that. And so this document brings this fact up, and it says we really need to consider the chronic care model. The chronic care model looks beyond the one-on-one patient education and says, how do we, on a community basis, improve access to diabetes care? Well, certainly we want, number 3, I'm just going to start there, change the care system. And they even suggest that maybe instead of offering our courses or our programs within hospital traditional settings, think of partnering with outside agencies like pharmacies. I know a lot of pharmacists are setting up diabetes programs in their pharmacies. Great. That's where people go to get their meds. It's a natural place they're going to go to. Looking at senior center, looking at churches or synagogue or religious institutions, partnering with them where people in the community normally go. Because the more access people have to education, the better their outcomes are going to be. So it's asking us to think outside the box. We also want to support behavior change by our patients. We know that diabetes management requires behavior change. And how do we encourage our patients to make those changes and stick with it? And then the first one is optimize provider and team behavior. So really making sure that the provider and the healthcare team are collaborating and referring and interdependent on, you know, what and providing diabetes care and really having a strong system there. The other thing they say in this document, this is number one. Number one, keep it patient-centered. This is amazing. I mean, that is truly the heart of diabetes education. We have to consider the individual. It is clear that optimal diabetes management requires an organized, systematic approach and the involvement of a coordinated team of dedicated health professionals. So we need all of us in this coordinated team and a system. But look it, we need to work in an environment where patient-centered care is a high priority. And so meeting the patient where they're at. Okay, so now we're going to move on to standard two. And standard two looks at criteria and screening criteria, who's at risk for diabetes. And certainly we know, if you look at this BMI category, it's once we get to BMI greater than 25, slightly overweight, and BMI 30, overweight or obese, that our risk of diabetes goes up. And so traditionally we have said, start screening for diabetes when the BMI is 25 or greater and they have additional risk factors. That's for the general population, but as it turns out, certain populations have a risk at a lower BMI. And so this is for the Asian Americans. They noted that for Asian Americans, they tend to store extra weight viscerally. If you look at this bottom picture here on the right, you can see that dark red circle represents visceral adiposity relative to subcutaneous adiposity. So the Asian American group tends to hold extra weight more viscerally against the organs, which increases risk of diabetes and increases insulin resistance and is associated with the metabolic syndrome. So what we're saying now is let's start looking at populations and look at their unique characteristics and base our screening on that. And so certainly for Asian Americans, a BMI of 23 or greater is a recommended cutoff to evaluate if they have diabetes or are at risk for diabetes. That was a main change. I just want to go back one slide. That was a main change for classification and diagnosis of diabetes. And in your resource page, I'm going to add a little cheat sheet on the criteria and diagnosis for prediabetes and diabetes so you have an easy reference, and I've included this change in that. Section 3, initial evaluation and diabetes management planning. So the first thing we want to do when we meet a patient with diabetes is to do an evaluation, and this is a medical evaluation, but even as a diabetes educator, maybe some of you are, you know, nurse practitioners or PAs or you know, providers, and maybe some of you are pharmacists and other professions, but in a way we all do this medical evaluation really regardless of our training. And the first thing is we want to classify the diabetes, and I know you probably all have met a patient and they've said, oh, this patient has type 2 diabetes, and you're like, really? Because they kind of seem like more of a type 1. Or sometimes I just had a patient come in the other day, he was diagnosed as a type 1. I'm like, wow, he kind of seems like a type 2. So we need to classify clearly what kind of diabetes they have, because that's an important distinction to determine, you know, how we're going to treat that. And so sometimes it is difficult to classify. And actually, I've been reading a lot of studies now that many of our patients actually have both types of diabetes, also known as double diabetes, especially with type 1s as they get older and gain extra weight. And maybe their parents had type 2 diabetes, they actually may manifest type 1 and type 2. And so that's kind of being published in the literature a little bit more right now, but I think we want to consider that. We want to look for diabetes complications. You know, what complications might this patient have? Eye, kidney, nerve disease, and vascular disease are the main things we're looking for. We want to look at what was their previous treatment. So we want to ask them, hey, in the past, how did you manage your diabetes? How is that working for you now? And then we want to look at their risk factors, so an assessment of risk factors. And really important, we want to help them develop a plan of care, a management plan. And that's a very important role that we have, is to say, okay, you're here. Here are the goals. How are we going to get you from where you're at now to help you get closer to these goals? So helping them set behavior change goals and helping with medication adjustment with provider approval, of course, is a part of a very important part of what we do also. And then we want to provide continuing care. You'll read a lot in the literature that says Diabetes education and diabetes care is not just a one-shot effort. We need to bring patients back in over time and call them and connect with them, because diabetes management over a lifetime is really challenging, complicated, and difficult. And even the patients who start off gung-ho and are doing a great job, they still need support on an ongoing basis, because as you know, a lot of patients take diabetes vacations. I'm sure you've met them. Some of my patients have gone on a one-week vacation, and some of them have been on a three-month sabbatical. But whatever they're doing, we just want to encourage them to come back and just start from today. Part of our initial evaluation when we look at people with diabetes, for type 1, we're going to certainly look for autoimmune diseases. So we know that type 1 is an autoimmune disease, and that people with type 1 diabetes are more likely to get autoimmune diseases. And the highest prevalence of autoimmune disease would be the celiac disease and thyroid disease. So those are things we're really on the lookout for, but they can also experience other types of autoimmune diseases. So we're always kind of just listening for those and looking. Other conditions that may appear in type 1 and type 2 that we want to evaluate for is depression and anxiety. People with diabetes certainly have a higher rate of depression and anxiety, and when those go untreated and unrecognized, it may really impact their ability to provide self-care. And so we want to address that and help provide management and skills and strategies to treat that. Obstructive sleep apnea. So if you're teaching your patients and they're falling asleep on you, it may not be you. It may be they're not sleeping well at night. We certainly know that people who are overweight and have diabetes are much more likely to express sleep apnea, and people with sleep apnea are often more likely to have diabetes. They're interrelated. Fatty liver disease. This is a really big problem throughout our country as we get heavier. And patients, especially with diabetes who are obese, have a very high risk of fatty liver disease. And fatty liver disease can just stay as fatty liver disease, or it can move on to NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. And so what we want to do is assume our patients who are overweight with diabetes are walking toward fatty liver disease, and we want to really encourage them to lose weight and exercise. Those are the two best treatments to prevent progression of fatty liver disease, weight loss in particular, because when you lose weight, you release the fat from those hepatocytes. Cancer. People with diabetes are a much more higher risk for breast cancer, pancreas, and liver cancer. And so we certainly want to encourage them to do the appropriate screenings. But again, weight loss and exercise, very important. And looking at other risk factors like smoking and alcohol intake. And their food consumption, of course. So, you know, those high-fat foods seem to not be very supportive of cancer prevention. So really encouraging healthy eating. Fractures. This is new. People with diabetes are at greater risk for fractures, ankle wrist fractures, and also hip problems. So we really want to help people with diabetes to not fall. And, you know, you've heard the stats. Once people fall, they're more likely to have fractures, and they're more likely to, you know, become more ill. And so during class, I do a lot of balance activities with patients, especially my older patients, and encourage them to keep moving. Okay, cognitive impairment. This is so much information, so I might have to edit myself a little bit. People with diabetes are more likely to get dementia and Alzheimer's. We really want to get those blood sugars down to improve mentation. Men with diabetes, more likely to have low testosterone. We want to screen for that if indicated. Periodontal disease. We know that gum disease increases blood sugars, and high blood sugars increase risk of gum disease. So very frequent, you know, brushing and flossing, and then regular checkups at the dentist. Oddly enough, you thought that was enough. Diabetes can also cause hearing impairment. There can be neuropathy of the bones in the ear that conduct sound. So these are all things we want to look out for when we're talking to our patients with diabetes. Okay, so number four, foundations of care. So now we've kind of set the framework. This is what's happening in diabetes. This is what we're going to look for. Now we're working with patients with diabetes. What are the foundations of care? I love that they put this as number four, and look what the foundations are. It doesn't start with medication. It does not. It starts with education. And I kind of think of it as this tree here. Here's a foundation, this big rock, and we're planting seeds, and we're hoping that seed grows. We're planting seeds of advocacy, of information, of behavior change, of coaching. And sometimes that ground is pretty firm and there's not much room for growth, but hopefully over time the person with diabetes is able to adopt new behaviors and see themselves in a different way, and so they can really embrace taking care of themselves and preventing complications. So education, there's a lot of information on education. And so what I'm going to do during this webcast is refer you to other classes I teach where I go into great detail on these topics. And I do have a course in my Level 2 program, Setting Up a Successful Diabetes Education Program, where I talk about developing an ADA-recognized program, what are the standards around that, and what are some issues that we need to be aware of around education. The second one is nutrition. Nutrition is so big, and also physical activity. And there's a whole position statement just on nutrition that was released late 2013, and it really changed the way we look at nutrition therapy in many ways, significant changes. And I do teach an online course in Level 1, in our Level 1 program, Nutrition and Exercise, that details those changes. Smoking cessation, a big deal. You know that smoking increases risk of cardiovascular disease. We really need to address that. Psychosocial care cannot be ignored. We've already know that people with diabetes have more depression and anxiety, and we know that if they're not able to cope with their diabetes, they can't manage it. Like, we see inability to cope reflected in high A1Cs, right? We see that in increasing body weight. And so that psychosocial limitation reflects in their health. We want to really address that. And we'll talk about immunization. There's been some changes in that also. So now I'm just going to address these in a little bit more detail. We're still on number four, standard four. People with diabetes should receive DSME, and we should monitor if it's working and if it improves quality of life. We should really address well-being of our patients, and we know that education results in quality of life improvement, but also cost savings, and it should be reimbursed by third-party payers. This is for pre-diabetes and diabetes. So currently, pre-diabetes is not paid for. Pre-diabetes education is not covered by Medicare. Some private insurance companies cover it, but we really do want to advocate and say, we know education helps stop people with pre-diabetes from moving to diabetes. So let's get this reimbursed so we can provide it in our work settings. The exercise recommendations were updated to include this very important comment in bold here. Activity update, don't sit for more than 90 minutes at a time. Just so you all know, the average American sits 9.5 hours a day, 9.5 hours a day. And I work with a lot of older patients, and they sit a lot. So we're constantly talking about how can you get up? Get up during the commercials. Get up and stretch every 15 minutes. I don't care, but don't sit more than 90 minutes. And the other thing, in addition to walking or being active 150 minutes a week, is to do at least 2 weekly sessions of resistance exercise, lifting weights, doing the rubber band, you know, just something where you're using your muscles in a resistance format, I guess is the best description. And so when you engage in muscle resistance, you build muscle. And guess what? 85% of glucose is used by the muscle. So the more muscle resistant training you do or resistant exercise, the more muscle mass you build and the more sugar you burn. So, wow, it's such an important part of maintaining muscle mass, balance, and overall health is resistance on training. Here's some good exercise information quotes. 20% of people walk 30 minutes a day. Look at this. Exercise really doesn't decrease your body weight generally, but it does decrease your A1C up to almost 1 percentage point. So I do refer to my patients, and I'll say, exercise is like a medication. And I'll say, you know what? If they're on insulin, you going for a 30-minute walk is worth about 2 units of insulin, you know, kind of based on their insulin dose. And so I said, instead of increasing your insulin, let's see if we can use exercise as a medication. And I've been doing this for 20 years, and for some reason, that really resonates with people when I say that. They're like, really? I'm like, yeah, instead of increasing your oral medication dose, could you walk 10 minutes after dinner? Let's give it a try. And so they get this sense of empowerment and motivation, because most people don't want to increase their medications. Look at this. When people exercise, we don't see a change in body weight usually unless they're, you know, extreme athletes. but we do see a 50% loss in visceral fat. So even though we don't see weight loss when people exercise, we do, if we looked at visceral adiposity, that drops by half. Mike Huckabee was running for president, and he has type 2 diabetes. He was very overweight, 100 pounds overweight, and during his campaign for presidency, he still managed to exercise every day. And they asked Mike, how do you make time to exercise? He goes, I don't have time. I make time. And I think it's true for a lot of our patients. They'll say, I don't have time to do exercise. Well, it needs to be a priority for you. I don't say it that way, but, you know, if people make things a priority, they will make it happen. Here's the best shake for people with diabetes. This is from Devi Nagata's slide collection. I love this. The only diet shake I recommend is the shake your booty makes when you exercise. And so it just kind of reminds me that people are more likely to exercise if it's fun. They have to enjoy it and really look forward to doing it because that inertia can take hold. Let's talk about vaccinations and immunizations. So the influenza vaccine recommendations stayed the same. Start vaccinating at age 6 months. Hepatitis B, that's, you know, in the past 2 years for patients age 19 to 59 who are not previously vaccinated, we recommend a hepatitis B vaccine because of their increased risk of getting hepatitis B due to lancing devices and glucose meter exposure. I've heard many patients say to me, yeah, my friend came over and I used my machine to check their blood sugar. So, of course, you know, we teach them that's really not appropriate because you could be transmitting, you know, blood-borne diseases. But they just do it out of kindness and they don't know. But this happens a lot more behind the scenes, and this is one way that hepatitis B is transmitted, not only in the community but a lot of times in nursing homes. The pneumonia vaccination recommendations have been changed, and this is based on the CDC. So the CDC has said, you know, to really get good coverage from the pneumonia viruses, the variety of them, we actually recommend double vaccination for older adults. So let's just start with the first thing. Pneumonia polysaccharide PPSV23 vaccine for all patients starting at the age of 2. But if they're over 65 years of age, your patients, and not previously vaccinated, they should first receive the conjugate vaccine PCV13, followed by the PPSV23, and you have to wait at least 8 weeks, but recommend it 6 to 12 months after initial vaccination. So they want to give more broad coverage to protect against pneumonia. If they're over 65 years of age and previously vaccinated with the PPSV23, they should receive a follow-up after 12 months with the other version. The thing is, if you get pneumonia when you have diabetes, you're much more likely to die and be hospitalized. And so there's a big emphasis, since people with diabetes already have suppressed immune systems because of hyperglycemia, we want to really work on prevention of disease states. And this pneumonia vaccine combination seems to be really effective. We're still on number 4, and they are talking about smoking cessation. So we all know about don't smoke. It's not good for your lungs, and smoking increases insulin resistance. So then a lot of people are turning to this e-cigarette. Now, this e-cigarette is still nicotine. It's a nicotine-laced vapor. But I was reading up on it online, and oftentimes they're laced with other bad stuff like formaldehyde and other chemicals. So these, you know, people are still breathing in nicotine and these vapors that might have some toxins in them. So e-cigarettes are not supported as an alternative to smoking to facilitate a cessation. That's what they're being marketed as. And, of course, you know who makes the e-cigarettes? The tobacco companies. So they're invested in people using this on an ongoing basis. So we want to bring up smoking and also the e-cigarettes. And certainly, I have this very famous Van Gogh picture here. So Van Gogh, before we even knew about the complications of cigarettes, painted this very provocative picture in that we know smoking increases risk of diabetes and risk of cardiovascular disease. So we need to ask at every visit about smoking, assist with stop smoking, and make sure to arrange for referrals if your patients are currently smoking. They need help. You know what? I used to feel like, oh, I'm such a nag bringing up smoking, but I bring it up every time. Because studies show the more you bring it up, the more likely they are to quit. This is the packaging for cigarettes packages in Brazil. And so actually when Brazil started putting this packaging on cigarettes, smoking rates went down. This is the packaging proposed for cigarettes in America. It's been blocked by the, well, you know who it's being blocked by, cigarette companies. So they say it's a freedom of speech violation. So we'll see what happens with this. But I think those are very effective too. Okay, we made it to number five. So number five standard talks about prevention or delay of type 2. And what it says is for people with pre-diabetes, we really want to refer them early on to behavioral counseling and diabetes self-management education programs. And here's our goals. We want to focus on intensive diet and physical activity. Weight loss target of 7%. Listen, weight loss early in the course of diabetes protects beta cells. Just a weight loss of 7% can do amazing things to improve the, the health of the beta cells and prevent diminishment. So we really want to help our patients with prediabetes or diabetes to lose some weight early on, so important. Increase physical activity. And then we want to follow up. Counsel, it's critical for success. If patients have prediabetes, we don't want to just provide one intervention and forget about it. We need to follow up and see how they're doing. And then here, this is metformin therapy. So we want to consider metformin therapy for people with prediabetes to prevent type 2 diabetes if they're high risk. So if their A1C is 5.7 to 6.4 and their BMI is 35 or greater and they have a history and or they have a history of gestational diabetes, consider metformin. And then, you know what? So just having prediabetes almost like doubles your risk for cardiovascular disease. So we want to monitor them annually and screen and mitigate modifiable cardiovascular risk factors. So looking at their blood pressure, their cholesterol, smoking, activity, all of that. Very, very important. Now this is based on data from the Diabetes Prevention Program that was released by the CDC, the results in 2001. And what they found is that if you have prediabetes and you make no changes in your lifestyle, in 3 years, you have a 30% chance of moving on to diabetes. But if you engage in lifestyle, you have a 58% risk reduction. And if you're over the age of 60, a 71% risk reduction in getting diabetes. And that's just what I talked about right now. What you need to do is 30 minutes a day of activity and lose 5 to 7% of your body weight. They also saw that if they started these patients with prediabetes on metformin in the trial, they had a 31% risk reduction of diabetes. For every 2.2 pounds of weight loss for people with prediabetes, the risk of type 2 was reduced by 13%. So those little changes in weight make a big difference. So if you have prediabetes, steps to prevent it, and I do want to talk about healthy eating in this context. Really eating high fiber, low fat, avoid sugar sweetened beverages. The ADA has come out very strongly against sugar sweetened beverages as it increases blood sugar and also possibly visceral adiposity. And I just read a study that was saying drinking a soda a day, a 20-ounce soda a day, decreases your life expectancy by a few years. So there's so many indicators against sodas. That would be the one thing we'd really encourage our patients to avoid. This is the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists who put out this pre-diabetes algorithm. I just thought it's interesting for you to take a look at. It's not the American Diabetes Association, but it does provide a different perspective on helping people with pre-diabetes not move on to diabetes. And both organizations start with lifestyle modification. And it says including medically assisted weight loss, which means gastric bypass. And then we move on to, of course, other interventions. You could take a look at that. Now let's move on to the ABCs of diabetes. So the standards of care really shook up the ABCs of diabetes this year, but we still need to look at A1C, blood pressure, and cholesterol, but there's been some changes in those. So let's head on to those right now. So the glycemic targets for adults have not changed, but I'd just like to spend a minute going over it because I think sometimes we might ask our patients to get their A1C to a goal that's not realistic for them or safe. And sometimes when I work with providers, they really want to push an A1C to a place that it's not realistic for a patient or safe. So let me just talk about this a little bit. But for most adults, A1C less than 7% is a reasonable goal. it might be appropriate to get those who don't have significant risk of low blood sugar or other adverse effects of treatment less than 6.5. So what does this mean, adverse effects of treatment? Well, to get an A1C less than 6.5, you have to use either a lot of medications, oral or insulin, and you have to really intensify it. So that person has to be able to manage it at a more intensive regimen. But look what this says. An A1C of less than 8 may be appropriate for patients with a history of hypo. Limit to life expectancies are those with long-standing diabetes and vascular complications. So really, we want to assess the patient's individual risk factors, their history, their life expectancy, and determine what goal best matches them. And certainly, if I have a patient with an A1C of 13%, I'm not going to say, oh, our goal is to get you less than 7, you know, immediately. I'm going to say, let's just get that less than 10. And so we keep working. The A1C goal is relative to what they started with. And so we just want to keep chipping away at it and with an eventual goal of reaching these targets. Now, the pediatric glycemic targets did change in 2015. They used to vary the targets based on the age, but now they say for all kids of all ages less than 18, the A1C goal now is less than 7.5. So they don't differentiate anymore, just straightforward goal. But however, individualization is still encouraged. And if a person can tolerate it, a kid, we can push that A1C less than 7 if they can achieve it without a lot of low blood sugar. This is new too, the blood glucose goals for pediatrics. They used to differentiate it by age, and now they just said, here's the standard goals, which is so much easier. And that is before meals, 90 to 130, and overnight, 90 to 150. And the reason they have the 90, as you can already imagine, is that their risk of hypoglycemia is so profound, they want to, you know, prevent that from happening. So these are the new targets for peds, giving them a nice safety net, especially overnight. We don't want that blood sugar less than 90. But interestingly enough, they don't say less than 180, so they kind of give a little bit less wide girth than adults who have as a postprandial less than 180. So they kind of say, let's just try and get that target less than 150 after meals. Okay, so the A1C goals for non-pregnant adults, I just mentioned this, but I'm just going to repeat it one more time, less than 7 in general. For individual patients, less than 6.5. Maybe some of our patients, it's less than 8. How often do we check A1C? This is really, I think, helpful because a lot of my patients get their A1C checked every quarter, and they don't really need to if they're meeting their target. If their A1C is always 6.4, 6.3, 6.7, they could probably get it checked 2 times a year. And if patients not meeting goal, if they're running, 11 and 9 and 8.7, we're going to do it more frequently. So we want to base the frequency on how their blood sugars are doing. Those are the ADA goals for A1C, but I also want to mention the AACE goals. So they have a different strategy. And if anyone here is thinking about taking the CDE exam, they definitely do bring up AACE goals in the exam. So I like to cover that, but it's also good to know. Because generally what I think about the difference between ADA, American Diabetes Association, is more, I would say, reality-based, because they come more from a community perspective, like what's universally able for most people to do. The AACE says, okay, for the endocrinologists who are specialists in diabetes, this should be their target. So you can see ADA, general population, AACE, I think more for the specialized population who gets access to an endocrinologist so they can really promote these tighter goals. So anyways, they have A1C less than 6.5 for healthy patients and more than 6.5 if they're at risk for low or have concurrent illness. So it's pretty general, but it gives you a guideline. Just to kind of talk about the A1C test, I had a patient ask me yesterday, what does this test measure? And I say, well, it measures your red blood cells, and your red blood cells live in your body and your bloodstream for 2 to 3 months. So they kind of record the history of your blood. And if there's been a lot of sugar in your blood for the last 2 to 3 months, guess what? Your red blood cells get sugar-coated. And I often say think about your red blood cells as a donut. And the more, so your red blood cells are floating around, and the more sugar in your blood, the more glazed your donuts get. So I kind of summarize saying the A1C test looks to see how glazed are your donuts. And you don't want your red blood cells looking like Krispy Kreme donuts, because that means everything is sticky. You want your red blood cells looking like plain donuts from Safeway. Or just some other patient said, looking like a Cheerio. I'm like, yeah, like a Cheerio. That's a good analogy, too. I do want to say it's a weighted mean. So 50% of the result is from the most recent month. And the other 50% is 2 months before. Each point of A1C equals about 29 points of blood sugar, and it can be the accuracy of the test results can be affected by anemias, hemoglobinopathies, anything that misshapes the red blood cells, or if they their red blood cells aren't living their usual 2 to 3 months, or they're getting blood transfusion. And so this test is good because it measures not only the fasting state of blood sugars, but also postprandial. So you really do get a nice reflection of their overall blood sugar control. I had a patient come in to see me, and he's like, Bev, I don't have diabetes. I have borderline diabetes. And I'm like, really? What's your A1C? And he's like, well, 11.3. And so I showed him this chart, and he's like, oh, yeah. I go, yeah, normally people with diabetes have A1Cs around 6, and you're here. So a normal A1C, when he saw that a normal A1C was closer to the 6% and he was here, it was a really good indicator to him that it was above normal. So you can order these really nice tear-off sheet charts from the ADA. They're free. And I use this as a really good teaching point when I meet with my patients to show them where they're at and where we want to go. Okay, this is new, so highlight this. Glucose goals for 2015. We want to individualize, but they increased the preprandial blood glucose goal to 80 to 130. As you know, it used to be 70 to 130, but they want to better reflect new data comparing actual average glucose levels with A1C target. So based on an analysis, again, of the relationship between blood sugars and A1C, they found that this is a safe goal that prevents complications, and that's the bottom line of what we want to do. They left the 1 to 2 hour postprandial less than 180, but they just, I really appreciate this because a lot of my patients, you know, they're running 74, and I'm like, I don't really feel comfortable with that. I want to provide a big safety net against hypoglycemia. So with these new guidelines, we feel more reassured that we'll help our patients stay in a safe zone. Number 7 is approaches to glycemic management, and I have to say that section is really great. It would take me like 3 hours to go over that section in detail. So I do want to invite you to join our Meds for Type 2. We have a webcast coming up January 19th where I'm going to be going over the medications and talking about the new algorithm. And then I have a Meds Management Part 2 for Type 2 on February 4th. And what I'll be talking about there is how to apply these different algorithms to help manage your patient's diabetes and help make adjustments in their medications. So the first class is what are these meds, what do they do, what are the side effects? The second class is now that we know what they do, how do we manage it? Where do we start? How do we use these algorithms in our practice? So if you want to join us, we'd love to have you. And then I'm going to have this class called Insulin Pattern Management Gone Crazy. And that's part 2 in our level 2 series, and I'm going to talk about how to apply the algorithms using for the insulin therapy. And so I'm available to go over that with you, but right now I'm just going to give you some snippets of what they talked about in this ADA Standards of Care. And again, I would encourage you to read that section. It's the section 7. It's fantastic. So here again, they start with lifestyle. So this is steps to manage hyperglycemia and type 2. So you start with lifestyle, healthy eating, weight management, increased physical activity, and look at this, diabetes education. I mean, that's just a 5-star. Then what they say, add metformin. We know this. When lifestyle alone is not achieving A1C goal, metformin should be added at or soon after diagnosis, unless contraindicated. Well, you know what the contraindications are if the kidneys aren't working. Because if the kidneys aren't working good, they can't clear the metformin metabolites, and they can lead to lactic acidosis. So traditionally, we've been using the creatinine as the cutoff. But look what they say. This is great information. We may want to start using GFR as a safety indicator for metformin. It may be a more appropriate measure than creatinine to screen for risk. They suggest if GFR is less than 45, decrease the max dose of metformin to 1,000, and of less than 30, stop metformin. So I'm definitely going to integrate this in my practice. I will look at creatinine, but I'm also going to look at GFR. And when I make recommendations to providers, I'll be considering both of these numbers. And I think this is going to give us a little more accurate recommendations of who's safe and not safe for metformin. Actually, you know, Europe has been using GFR for years as an indicator, so we're just we're a little bit slower than Europe. We're still not on the metric system, which is kind of perplexing. Okay, metformin has a long-standing evidence base for efficacy and safety, and it may help reduce cardiovascular risk. So it's our go-to drug. It's our number one guy. It works great. It's super cheap. You can get a three-month supply from Walmart for $10, three-month supply, $10 cash pay. If A1C target is not achieved after 3 months, consider adding one of the six treatment options or basal insulin, and that's what we're going to talk about in our medications program. You can add another medication. You don't ever stop metformin unless it's contraindicated. You added an additional medication. Now look what it says now. Consider starting dual therapy, so at diagnosis, if A1C is 9% or greater. So now this is more information than they used to give us. So if A1C is 9% or greater, let's start metformin and maybe some basal insulin or metformin and another medication. And then after the A1C comes down, we can back off a little bit. But we know when the A1C is 9% or greater, there's a degree of glucose toxicity, and it might be hard to get blood sugars to go. Okay, A1C still above target, consider basal bolus therapy or add a GLP-1 agonist. That's our exenatide, Victoza, liraglutide, Tanzium, those medications. Or, this is brand new, I was so excited to see this, consider twice daily pre-mixed biphasic insulin, 70-30. Wow! So the American Diabetes Association has given us some really good tools to help get those A1Cs and blood sugars to target. Here's their hyperglycemia algorithm for type 2. You can see they start with healthy eating, weight control, physical activity, diabetes education, and metformin. That's the top tier. And then, this is a really great chart. They look at efficacy, hypoglycemia risk, weight, side effects, costs, and they rate each of these medications, sulfonylurea, thiazolidinones, all of them. And that helps inform you of which medication to use for which patient. Like if your patient is already overweight or obese, you don't want to add a sulfonylurea because this causes weight gain. You want to look for a medication that causes weight loss, like SGLT2 or GLP-1 receptor. And so in our medication management class, we'll be talking about this and going over this in a lot more detail. But if you just want to take a look at this on your own, I think it's very instructive. That's in Section 7. They also updated the insulin management guidelines for type 2, and I have to say it's really good. And you can see when you start somebody, this is type 2, of course, you start with basal insulin usually, and you say 10 units a day or, you know, 0.1 to 0.2 units of kilogram per day. Adjust, you know, 2 to 4 units once or twice weekly to reach fasting target. And if you get low blood sugar, decrease by 4 units or 10 to 20%, which I think is a great recommendation. Now, if it's not controlled, and I love this part, it's super small font, or if basal dose is more than 0.5 units of kilogram per day, consider a GLP-1 or go to extra insulin. Let me just talk about this for a minute. If I have a patient who weighs 100 kilograms, which is to say 200 pounds, and they're on 0.5 units of basal, that means 50 units. So if I have a patient who weighs 200 pounds and he's on more than 50 units of insulin, basal, a day, I need to take action. So I've seen in my practice that patients who weigh 200 pounds are on 80, 100, 120 units of basal. I know you all have seen that. And that's not the right strategy. Once they get to more than 0.5 units of insulin per kilogram per day, we've got to go to plan B, and that is add a GLP-1, or look what they say here, add one rapid insulin injection before largest meal. That is such, see, this is very common sense and achievable. And look what they say, start with 4 units. And they have some other information there. Or look over here. You could change to premix insulin twice a day. This is based in reality algorithm that I really appreciate. Let me just tell you one other thing about insulin. Lantus costs, a few hundred bucks a bottle, depending where you get it from. Pre-mixed insulins, 70/30 N&R, are, 30 bucks a bottle. So if your patients are cash pay or in a donut hole or, just have a huge copay, we want to consider the cost too. So then if the blood sugars are still high, add 2 rapid insulin injections before meals. That's called basal bolus. So take a look at this, but we'll be going over it in more detail in our insulin management course. It's very exciting because we need guidelines as diabetes educators and advocates. We may not be changing medications, but when we meet patients and their blood sugars are out of whack, we need some ideas of where to go. Number 8, cardiovascular disease and risk management. I'm going to spend some time on this because they really updated this in 2 major ways, which we'll go over in a minute. But cardiovascular disease is a leading cause of mortality and morbidity in diabetes. We know that. Actually, we consider a person with diabetes who have a pre-existing cardiovascular condition. So just the fact of having diabetes means you're at risk for heart disease. You have a risk factor for heart disease. Heart disease is the largest contributor to direct and indirect costs associated with diabetes. And we know by controlling cardiovascular risk factors, we improve outcomes. It's one of the biggest things we can do. And large benefits are seen when multiple risk factors are addressed globally. So when we look at, the blood pressure, hyperlipidemia, we look at clotting risk, smoking, weight, all of those, the more of those risk factors we address, the less the risk is for that person. That seems obvious, but I think it's important to know. So here's a blood pressure goal for 2015. It even went up higher. It was 130 over 80 originally a few years back, and then it went up to 140 over 80, but now they cranked up the diastolic to 90. Why? Studies indicated that previous blood pressure target of 140 over 80 or 130 over 80, which was the original one, didn't improve outcomes enough to balance the risk of side effects. And you know the side effects, orthostatic hypotension, so people passing out from being on too much blood pressure medication, and then also the burden of taking so many medications, polypharmacy. And so they said, those are the side effects of getting the blood pressure down, because maybe instead of one med, you'll need 2 or 3 meds to reach that target. But maybe if we set the target at 140 over 90, they can get there with one medication, have less side effects, and still have better outcomes. So it does say here, though, that some patients may benefit from a blood pressure of 130 over 80 if they're younger, and they can achieve it without undue treatment burden. And treatment burden is, getting those side effects and being on a ton of medications. And so I think this is very interesting, and this was, based on a lot of studies that they reviewed, and I think this is a gift for our people with diabetes because, our patients with diabetes are on so many medications, and we only want to ask them to do stuff that's going to pay off, that's going to be worth the risk. And if it's not worth the risk, let's not do it. So here's the hypertension guidelines. We want to screen, check blood pressure at each visit. And if either systolic or diastolic is greater than our target, 140 over 90, repeat on a separate day. And so they have to go home and we repeat it to verify. And certainly we want to encourage them to do at-home monitoring. The other thing I do want to mention about taking blood pressure is we want to make sure the patient is sitting still for 5 minutes, feet on floor, arm supported, right size cuff, or else you can get false highs. So here's the treatment. I'm going to keep going here. To get to the first bullet point, this is interesting because if a person has diabetes, the first treatment target is to, if it's more, okay, let me say this again. If a patient has diabetes and their blood pressure is more than 120 over 80, we want to encourage lifestyle changes to reduce blood pressure. We don't wait till it's 140 over 90. We start here. Isn't that interesting? So we're trying, it's kind of a preventive approach. Let's help them. If we see that blood pressure higher than 120 over 80, can we help them with weight loss? Can we refer them to a dietitian to help with sodium intake? Can we encourage them to get exercising? You know what I mean? So we really want to use non-pharmacologic interventions to get that blood pressure better or keep it where it's at. But if the blood pressure is 140 over 90, we're going to do lifestyle plus prompt initiation. You don't wait 3 months. You start today of blood pressure medications. And I do want to talk about lifestyle changes. What does that mean? Weight loss, you know, that 5 to 7%. And then making sure they meet with a dietitian and get information on the DASH-style diet. Fresh fruit, veggies, whole grains, reducing sodium and increasing potassium intake helps with blood pressure. Making sure that they're not over-consuming alcohol and get active. So as far as treatment goes for blood pressure, the first-line blood pressure drugs are they've been around forever, the ACE inhibitors and the angiotensin receptor blockers. This is for type 2. And if one class is not tolerated, the other should be tried. So generally for type 1s, we use ACE inhibitors. We've got good data on that. Type 2s, we could use either one. Either one is well, helps with blood pressure. But you never add these two together. There's some interactions that happen when you put these two together, and it's hard on the kidneys and the RAS system. So we just, if we use one or the other. So if one class is not tolerated, the other should be tried. And if the one doesn't work, we will add a thiazide diuretic. That's the treatment strategy. Okay, let's talk about hyperlipidemia. That was also changed. So now we've changed the blood pressure goal, plus we've changed the lipid goals. The statin treatment and lipid monitoring were revised to reflect the 2013 findings of the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association. Listen to this. This is big for us because we've been stuck on this number, LDL less than 100, for a lot of years, right? I mean, I had that number like memorized. I could pull it out of my brain at any moment. But now they say statin therapy initiation is no longer based on LDL level. Starting and dosing stratification is driven by risk status. So Kaiser was already way ahead of the game on this. They've been doing this now based almost for a year, I think. So if you're a Kaiser employee, you know better than me, but I'm thinking about a year. Let me just talk about what this means. So let's talk about screening, and we'll just kind of go through. So now I'm just going through the standards the way they present it. So the first thing is dyslipidemia screening for, this is adults. Screening lipid profile is recommended at time of diagnosis, or if they're younger than 40, we start at 40 years of age. And then periodically thereafter, every 1 to 2 years. So, you know, we screen at diagnosis and when they reach the age of 40, and then every 1 to 2 years. And then what we're going to start with is lifestyle. So you've heard this before, reduce trans fat, saturated fat, cholesterol. So those high fat foods we want to reduce, make sure they, you know, hook up with a dietitian. And increase intake of omega-3 fatty acids, you know, from the salmon and those fish that carry that, viscous fiber, and plant stanols and sterols. So stanols and sterols are naturally occurring in small amount in grains, vegetables, fruit, legumes, nuts, and seeds. But if you want to get a bigger dose, it's actually being added now to margarine, OJ, and other food products. And these have been shown to decrease LDL levels. So one example is Benecol. They've added, you know, stanol or sterol to these food products to help lower cholesterol. Well, that doesn't mean you want to slather on butter on your English muffins because that has a lot of calories. Well, it's not actually butter. It's flavored margarine. I'm not sure they call it something. But you don't want to eat it ad lib. But if you are going to use butter, you might as well use something like Benecol to help improve your cholesterol. Okay, lose weight if indicated, and get active. So these are the lifestyle actions we're going to take for dyslipidemia. And now look at this. Intensify lifestyle therapy and optimize glucose control if triglycerides are elevated and the HDL is below target. There is nothing here about LDL cholesterol. So what they're saying is if you have diabetes, you already have a cardiovascular risk. What we're going to do is, you know, help with lifestyle. We're going to look at your triglycerides and HDL. If those are not at target, we're going to intensify lifestyle therapy. I love this little poster. Exercise to have fun and be healthy, not to just lose weight. Actually, exercise doesn't generally help people lose weight, but it helps you get more healthy. And I think that's the message we want to get across to people. Okay, now, I just thought I would show you the 2013 Prevention Guideline Tool, CV Risk Calculator, that the ADA is basing their new recommendations off of. You can Google this. It's a collaboration between the American Heart Association and the American College of Endocrinology. So what they do is you walk through this algorithm to see, based on your risk status, what medication or what statin, it's really, these are all about statins, what statin dosing should you be prescribed. And here's the cardiovascular risk factors as defined by them: gender, age, race, total cholesterol, look at LDL, doesn't even appear, HDL, systolic blood pressure, do you have hypertension and you're treated for it, diabetes, and smoker. So you can see diabetes is certainly a risk factor. So that's where this came from, and then this is how the ADA interpreted it. So let me spend a few minutes with you on this. Recommendations for statin treatment in people with diabetes. So if you're younger than 40 years of age and you have diabetes and you have no heart risk factors, we don't start patients on a statin. We just monitor them annually as needed or as needed. But if they already have a cardiovascular risk factor, and let's go down here to double asterisk to see what that means, including LDL cholesterol more than 100, high blood pressure, smoking, overweight, and obese, then we start them on a moderate to high statin dose. If they have overt cardiovascular disease, they've already experienced, let's look and see what that means, includes those with previous heart attack, stroke, angina, so previous cardiovascular events, we start them on a high statin dose. Okay, let's look at the next age group, 40 to 75. No risk factors. We still put them on a moderate statin dose. Just because of their age and they have diabetes, isn't that interesting? Not based on LDL, not based on any of that, just that they have no risk factors, but we still start them on a moderate statin dose because we know it improves outcome. If they're in this age group and they have cardiovascular risk factors or overt CVD, high dose. Okay, over the age of 75, no risk factors, still put them on a moderate dose. And again, if they have risk factors or overt CVD, moderate to high. And then we're going to evaluate their lipid panel as needed to monitor adherence. And I think this first asterisk is really important in addition to lifestyle therapy. So this does not replace lifestyle. This is in addition. And so what I've done is I wrote a list of some of the common statins and what would a high-intensity statin look like. So high-intensity statins lower LDL 50%, and that would be like Lipitor or Crestor. High-dose Lipitor 40 to 80, Crestor 20 to 40 milligrams a day. Moderate intensity, you see, doesn't lower LDL as much, so that would be Lipitor 10 to 20 milligrams or Crestor 5 to 10 milligrams. Low intensity was not mentioned in that chart because people with diabetes automatically go to moderate or high intensity if they're over the age of 40. This is from the ACC AHA cholesterol guidelines I referred to. This is their chart on high intensity, moderate intensity, and low intensity statin therapy. And this is just a nice reference for you to see the other additional medications under moderate. I couldn't fit them all in the slide, so I wanted to include that for you. And so this is a big change in the way that we manage, let me just go back, statins, LDL therapy, the way we look at, you know, cardiovascular risk in our patients with diabetes. We've got the blood pressure 140 over 90, and now we're going to start most of our patients, we're going to suggest that they get started on a statin. And our patients are going to need, if they're under 40, maybe none if they have no risk factors, but let me go back to that slide. But over the, if they have any risk factors, they're going to be started on moderate or high throughout, and they're going to be on that throughout their lifetime. Of course, you know, with statin therapy, we need to make sure our patients know to report any muscle weakness, muscle pain, and of course any changes in cognition. It can affect cognition in some people, and we're going to keep an eye on liver enzymes also. Okay, let's move on to aspirin therapy. So we're still in cardiovascular disease because cardiovascular disease is really big. It's a number one cause of death, mortality, and morbidity, so time is required on that. When we meet with our patients, we're going to spend time on it, and when we're thinking about management strategies, it's very important. So aspirin therapy, another important tool that we have. So let's start with who should not be on aspirin. Aspirin is not recommended for diabetes, if low heart risk and under the age of 50 for women and 60 for men. So if they don't really have any cardiovascular risk factors and they're under this age category, aspirin not recommended, because the side effect of bleeding outweighs the benefit, the potential benefit. But we're going to use for men over the age of 50 and women over the age of 60 who smoke or have a cardiovascular risk factor. And that's still considered primary prevention. We want to prevent a cardiac event. Now, let's move on. If they've already have cardiovascular disease and a history of cardiovascular event, we're going to use aspirin therapy. That's just no-brainer. We're going to get them on aspirin therapy every day, and the dose is 75 to 162, and you can kind of adjust that based on their risk. Now, listen to this. A combination therapy of Plavix, clopidogrel, I never say the generic, we'll just call it Plavix. A combination of aspirin and Plavix is reasonable for a year after myocardial infarction, but don't use aspirin in patients with aspirin allergy, obviously. Use Plavix instead. We're still on number 8. So this is a nice summary slide, and I'm really going to keep this in mind when I'm meeting with my patients with diabetes to see, are they on this regimen to help prevent a recurrence of their cardiovascular disease or worsening? And patients with known cardiovascular disease, make sure they're on aspirin, a statin, and blood pressure medication. Consider using an ACE inhibitor to reduce the risk of cardiovascular event. This is a person with CVD already. And in patients with prior MI, beta blockers should be continued for at least two years after the event. So beta blockers, very important therapy for people with diabetes who've had an MI, and they should be continued for 2 years. The other recommendations they have are don't use Actos or Avandia in patients with congestive heart failure because it can cause fluid retention. And they also added this, if patients have stable congestive heart failure, metformin can be used if renal function is normal and stable. So that gives us a little more flexibility, because before they said don't use metformin if they have CHF on medications. But this is relaxing that and saying, hey, if they're stable and their CHF is under control and they're not at risk for dehydration, let's consider metformin. Let's just take a look at a patient. Let's see if we can apply some of this. We have a 78-year-old man. He smokes a pack a day. His A1C was 8.1, down from 10.4, which is pretty darn good. His blood pressure is 136 over 76, so that actually does meet our guideline of 140 over 90. His morning blood glucose is 100. His two-hour postprandial is 190, so he's running a little bit high after meals. Here's his cholesterol. Triglycerides are 54. Wow, that's low, because less than 150 is our target. His HDL is 46, which meets the target of more than 40. And even though we have an LDL, we're not really going to use that to base our treatment, right? We're not going to use that to base our therapy anymore. We just know he has diabetes, he's at risk for heart disease. We're going to take action. So let's take a look at the meds he's on. He's on insulin, 16 units of Lantus at bedtime. He's on benazepril. That's an ACE inhibitor to lower his blood pressure. Is that working? It's looking pretty good. He's also on a beta blocker, metoprolol, and he had a heart attack. So he's on an ACE and a beta blocker. That's looking good, and that really reflects in his blood pressure. He's on a blood thinner, warfarin, to help prevent, you know, blood clots. He's obviously a high-risk cardiovascular candidate with that smoking. And he's on Actos, 15 milligrams. And so just thinking about him, what medication is missing from his regimen? What medication? You are right. It's a statin. This man needs to be on a statin. Even though his LDL is 98, that's not what we're going to base our therapy on anymore. We're going to base our therapy on his risk. He is very high risk with smoking and a history of heart disease. And so we see if a patient's on metoprolol or a beta blocker, even though I don't have it in their HMP that they've had a heart attack, I kind of think they had one. You know, it kind of gives me a sign that they probably had a heart attack. So we need to think about getting this guy into statin. Do we need aspirin therapy? Well, he's already on a blood thinner, so that might be okay. But certainly this man is high risk, and we want to make sure we get him access to treatment to stop smoking. And I have this other question here. Any special instructions for him? Well, since he is on a beta blocker and he's on Lantus, he might not feel sensations of low blood sugar because the beta blockers block many of the symptoms of low blood sugar. But you know what? Patients still do get sweaty when their blood sugar is low. It's not blocked by the beta blocker. So we can teach them. Look for, if you're getting sweaty, you don't understand why, it could be your low blood sugar. So, you know, beware of that. Let's take a look at another patient. Here's Mr. Jones. He's 62 years old with newly diagnosed type 2. He's had an MI and he's on meds, Lasix and Synthroid. Wow. Okay. So just right by reading that, we can identify a few medications that he's really lacking, right? What do you think? What are the two medications that just jump out to you? Aspirin and a statin right away. So now when we look at patients' HMPs, we can start really identifying quickly and early what their cardiovascular risk factors are and what medications might be lacking. Of course, at the cornerstone of all of this is lifestyle. So I want to give a shout out to lifestyle always. Here's his A1C 9.3 and the target's less than 7. HDL 37, you know, we want that a little bit higher, more than 40 at least. His LDL is giving us information. We're not going to base treatment on that, but obviously his LDL is high, so he's a really high risk for heart disease. Triglycerides, we want them less than 150, and the recommendations say intensify lifestyle. So we really want to talk to him about exercise, eating healthily, looking at his fat intake, processed food, all that stuff. We did a proteinuria that was negative. That's not good enough. We need to check for microalbuminuria and get a creatinine and a GFR on him. Here's his blood pressure. Okay, this blood pressure is not too bad. Our target's 140 over 90. Well, we do see he's on Lasix, and that's probably for blood pressure. So this gentleman really needs to be on, you know, we need to consider aspirin and a statin. And what about medications for diabetes? His A1C is 9.3, so we certainly want to evaluate what medication would be a good fit. But certainly one that pops out to me is metformin. He walks a dog around the block 3 times a week. Is that considered exercise? Absolutely it is. So we're excited about that, but we know based on his triglycerides that he could benefit from some more exercise. So we're definitely going to help him maybe increase that. Instead of maybe 3 times a week, he could go to 4 times a week. Or instead of walking around the block once, maybe he can do twice. We're going to have to negotiate that with him. Okay, let's keep going. So the ABCs of diabetes, A1C, less than 7%. And you can see here, I have not updated the slide yet. So you can update it on your handout and I'll redo the handout. But it should say pre-meal blood glucose, 80 to 130. And post-meal blood glucose, less than 180. And I did not update the blood pressure. So this should be, you all know what this should be, 140 over 90. So I will make those changes for you and re-upload the handout. 140 over 90. And then cholesterol, I did update this. Evaluate if statin therapy is indicated based on their age and their risk status. So here's all the things that people with diabetes need to do. They need to get their A1C, their blood pressure, their cholesterol checked, and this is going to be, we're going to look at triglycerides and HDL as our indicators, and we're going to really treat based on risk. We're going to look at their weight, their kidney function, eye, teeth, feet, physical activity, preconception. So let's move on to number 9, speaking of feet, is microvascular complications. So they did say here, every time you see your doctor, take off your shoes and socks and show your feet. And this is for people at risk of foot complications. So they have a high risk for foot complications. And those include patients with lots of protective sensation, foot deformities, or a history of foot ulcers. That's a new indication. That's new in the guidelines. So any patient with a high risk foot, make sure you show your doctor or your provider your feet every time you visit them. The kidney disease recommendations were slightly adjusted, and I would say they're simplified. But let's just go over these. With kidney disease, we definitely want to optimize glucose and blood pressure control to protect the kidneys. We want to screen for albumin, creatinine ratio, and GFR. For type 2, we do it at diagnosis and yearly. For type 1, after they've had diabetes for 5 years, and then we evaluate yearly. We're going to treat hypertension to protect the kidneys with an ACE or an ARB, and then we consider referral to a specialist when management is difficult and kidney disease is advancing. I do want to point out this last bullet point. This came from the MNT guidelines. We used to say that with kidney disease, we should decrease the protein intake, and that really is not based, doesn't seem to really improve outcomes, so they ditched that recommendation. So no longer recommended to limit dietary protein since it doesn't seem to improve outcomes. For eye disease, we want to optimize glucose and blood pressure control. We're going to screen with an initial dilated and comprehensive eye exam by an ophthalmologist or optometrist. For type 2s, a diagnosis then every 1 to 2 years. And with type 1s, within 5 years of diagnosis and then 1 to 2 years. It really, you do it more frequently if the eye disease is progressing and less frequently if things are safe and looking good. So for a lot of our clients who live in rural areas, it is approved to use high-quality fundus photography as a screening tool. But initial exam and thorough exam should be done in person, and the fundus photography is just a screen. If anything is identified, they would need to see the specialist in person. We want to promptly refer patients with macular edema and severe non-proliferative disease to a trained specialist, so a provider who specializes in eye disease and retinopathy. Treatment includes laser therapy, and for macular edema, there's been really great success with these injections of antivascular and endothelial growth factors. We've really been able to make a difference in improving macular edema. Now, for nerve disease, I really was impressed by this opening sentence. Tight glycemic control is the only strategy shown to prevent or delay the development and progression of neuropathy. And I've seen this over and over in my practice. If I have a patient who comes in with very bad nerve pain and their A1C is, 13, 15, 17, as we get that A1C down, their nerve pain does diminish. I do want to say, though, initially, as you get nerve pain down, or I'm sorry, as the A1Cs come down, nerve pain may intensify. But on the other side of that, it gets better. So glycemic control, number one. And of course, medications to manage pain come into play too. But also we want to encourage our patients to exercise, watch alcohol intake, and also, do some meditation. And yoga is really good for neuropathy too. So I'll put a lot of resources for you in the resource section. And I have a real nice sheet on neuropathy medications. So the other thing I want to say is screen all patients for nerve disease at diagnosis using simple tests such as monofilament, type 2 at diagnosis and annually, and type 1 at 5 years and annually. The real aim here is to reduce pain and improve quality of life. Neuropathy can be really detrimental to quality of life. The pain can be just so distressing to patients. And so we coach them a lot. And we help get them to providers and specialists that can help them. All right. That's microvascular disease. And as you know, I'm just highlighting key points. Obviously, in 90 minutes, I can't go into depth in each of these very important topics. So I would encourage you, just to take a look at the guidelines and read them. Kind of as you feel comfortable and you have time reading a section at a time. It's really full of great information. Okay, older adults, I really like this opening statement they have. If functional and cognitively intact with significant life expectancy, use the same goals as younger adults. So if we're working with, I work with a lot of older patients who are in their 90s and above, and they are vibrant, they are healthy, they are mentally clear, they're excited, they're committed. I have many patients in their 90s, believe it or not, on 4 injections of insulin a day, monitoring their blood sugars 4 times a day, and have excellent diabetes control. And I say to them, do you want to cut back on the intensity? They're like, no, we want to be in charge of this. So really, it's not the age, it's the person and their willingness and their abilities. That's what really matters. Glycemic goals may need to be relaxed with focus on quality of life. So we may have an older patient who's really just struggling to take their medications every day. They might be struggling with depression or trying to eat enough and all kinds of other factors. So for those patients, we might let that A1C go up to 8%. We definitely want to assess cardiovascular risk factors. As we get older, our risk of heart disease, heart attack, and stroke goes up. So we want to mitigate those. And I love this bullet point here. Focus screening for complications on those that would lead to functional impairment. So for example, you know, we want to evaluate their ability to walk and maintain balance. Is there neuropathy impacting that? And if so, that's going to decrease their quality of life. Or what about their vision? If they can't see that well, how can they take care of themselves and perform activities of daily living? So we really want to think about complication management as far as helping them have the most independent and best quality of life possible. And of course, if over the age of 65, they're at high risk for depression, we want to evaluate for that. A Section 11 on children and adolescents was really so excellent. It was very detailed and had a lot of great information. So I don't have time to go over it all during this webcast, but I am going to be recording my Kids and Diabetes course in February. So if you would like to join us after this webcast, I'll send you an invitation to these different upcoming webcasts. You can come join us for more detailed content on that. I just want to get back to this. A lot of us work mostly with adults, but sometimes we may work with children, and it's really important, I think, to know about diabetes throughout the whole care continuum. It really helps because we may have to, you know, in the future, if you're not working with kids, we may be in a situation where a kid needs our assistant or an adolescent, and we want to be able to provide that. Okay, well, Section 12 is gestational diabetes. And I do want to say that gestational diabetes is on the rise in America. It affects 7% of all pregnancies, and the prevalence has increased 10 to 100% in the past 20 years. And as with type 2 diabetes, it affects certain populations more than others. The issue with gestational diabetes is that if a woman gets gestational diabetes, her child is more likely to get diabetes, and she's more likely to get diabetes within 5 years of delivery of the baby. And so we're trying to think, can we avoid gestational diabetes? And there are some good studies now that are saying that if a woman goes into pregnancy at a healthy weight and she doesn't gain too much weight during her pregnancy, she can reduce her risk of getting gestational diabetes. And I think that's a really strong message we want to share with our mothers, our girls moving toward womanhood, to try and keep your weight at the best place possible, and especially when you're moving toward pregnancy. And during pregnancy, try not to gain too much. And so this is such a great opportunity because women are very highly motivated. So the ADA standards of care, here's their summary of key points, and that is provide preconception counseling, focus on importance of glycemic control, and A1C less than 7 to prevent anomalies. You know, so any woman with pre-existing diabetes needs to protect against getting pregnant until she's ready to conceive, because any degree of hyperglycemia in the first 3 months of the baby's development can lead to congenital anomalies, especially in the nerves, nerve growth and development. And so we really want to impress upon women, you know, who have diabetes, please make sure you have your A1C less than 7 before you get pregnant and provide them with resources for that. This was really interesting. I think this was new. I don't remember seeing it last year. Avoid using teratogenic meds like ACE inhibitors and statins in women with diabetes who are sexually active and not using reliable contraception. Because if a woman gets pregnant and she's on these medications and, you know, for diabetes and high blood pressure, that can cause, again, anomalies with her child, with her fetus. We're going to manage gestational diabetes with diet and exercise first, and then add medications as needed. And then we want to provide a baseline eye exam for women with pre-gestational diabetes. So that's pre-existing diabetes before they get pregnant. We want to check their eyes and then monitor every trimester. The A1C target during pregnancy is less than 6% if it can be achieved without hypoglycemia. That's a pretty tough goal to reach, but it improves outcomes. Meds that are used in pregnancy include insulin, metformin, and glyburide. But metformin and glyburide are not FDA approved to be used during pregnancy. They're off-label. They're still being used in many centers. So insulin is approved. Metformin and glyburide are used, but they're off-label. Some of the, you know, studies that have come out seem to indicate that they're safe, even though they do, I believe they cross up placentas, so, but it, they seem to be okay. Now I'm going to have to double check that, but I just want to let you know they're class B. And so they seem to be okay, but we still need some more long-term safety data. Okay, so screening pregnant women before 13 weeks. So if a woman gets pregnant, we want to screen her for diabetes. And that's pretty much any woman who has any of the diabetes risk factors. So we screen for type 2, undiagnosed type 2, at the first prenatal visit. And if her blood sugar is 126, you know, fasting, if it meets the criteria for diabetes, then she now has diabetes in pregnancy. That's not gestational diabetes. She's treated as a person with diabetes, you know, in pregnancy. So we've got to get her blood sugars down right away. But if when we check her, her blood sugars are normal, then we don't check her again until 24 to 28 weeks. And then we're going to check for gestational diabetes. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but there still are two different criteria to evaluate if a woman has gestational diabetes. There's the one step, and there's the NIH two step. So you can take a look at those. Those are still both acceptable ways of evaluating if a woman has gestational diabetes. But after they deliver, the important point is they're going to have a 50% risk of getting diabetes in 5 years. And so we want to really use this time to say to that woman, now's your time to get healthy, to lose weight, to breastfeed, to exercise, to keep connected with your healthcare team, and get that blood pressure and your lipids to target. And we want to encourage them to get preconception counseling. That means helping them, you know, wait to get pregnant until they're really ready. And so this is very important to get the women back into our system after delivery. Oftentimes they're lost, and we really need to follow up since there's such high risk for getting diabetes, and their children are at greater risk for getting diabetes too. Okay, you guys are doing a great job of sticking with it here. Section 13, diabetes care in the hospital, nursing home, and skilled nursing facility. We know this. We know these are common sense, but it's so nice to have it in black and white for those of us working in a hospital setting so we can bring to our administration and say, you know what, we're really struggling here with getting the provider's attention on the importance of diabetes. And then we can say these are the ADA standards of care. And that's why the ADA publishes these. They publish them so that we have a reference to refer to, so that we can say these are the standards set by the national organization based on science and research. And if you look at those standards, they cite a ton of research articles. And so they give us, they empower us. The standards of care empower us to provide the best care to our patients. So you want to start discharge planning on admission. And a lot of times our patients come in on oral medications for the diabetes, and now what we're doing, a lot of hospitals, we're stopping the oral medications and putting them on insulin therapy. And so I would say one of the biggest issues that hospitals are struggling with is getting them back on their oral medication before discharge. So we need to start planning around that because sometimes I see patients going home on sliding scale insulin, so let's take a look at that. We want to avoid sole use of sliding scale insulin during the hospital stay. And so during the hospital stay, we really want to be more proactive and give them some basal insulin, and we want to use insulin to cover their meals. Sliding scale insulin is really not, doesn't get blood sugars to target effectively, and we certainly don't want to discharge anybody on that. Look at this. This was new. Clearly identify type of diabetes on admission. As I mentioned earlier, many times patients are miscategorized. So we want to make sure if we know they're type 1 or type 2, because the type 1 is going to absolutely need insulin with every meal to prevent diabetic ketoacidosis and, you know, hyperglycemia. So it helps us stratify and prepare for discharge. So the goals for critically ill patients remain the same. Start insulin if blood glucose is 180 or greater, and that's whether or not they have diabetes. So that means diagnosed or not diagnosed, blood sugar 180, start insulin. And many times in the units, we'll start an insulin drip. We might do basal bolus, but the goal is to get blood sugars 140 to 180. And some patients, particularly CABG, the coronary artery bypass surgery graft, might benefit from even tighter control. For non-critically ill patients, the goals are similar to what they were last year. Pre-meal less than 140, post-meal less than 180. They don't set a bottom parameter, which I think is kind of interesting. They don't say 80 to 140 or 80 to 180. That's really depends on your organization. But we're trying hard in our hospital, to prevent hypoglycemia. And so, I'm just kind of considering maybe we'll copy the outpatient goal of 80 to 140 to give us a little safety net against low blood sugar. Basal bolus, preferred treatment. So that's giving fast-acting insulin at every meal and long-acting insulin at night based on the patient's weight and their diabetes presentation. You need to make sure to have a hypoglycemia protocol. So what are you going to do in case of low? And I love this. This seems new to me. I don't remember it last year. Get A1C in all patients with diabetes or hyperglycemia. So on admission, we should be getting A1Cs to see what has that patient been up to, from a glycemic perspective, and what should we discharge them on. The last standard has to do with diabetes advocacy. And that is saying people living with diabetes should not face discrimination. People with diabetes are protected under the American Disabilities Act and should be afforded all the benefits of people without diabetes. And as diabetes educators and providers and, as people, as part of this community, we all need to be a part of advocating for the best care and the rights of people living with diabetes. And so I think this is what these standards really drive home. They give us a framework to work from. They help us say these are the gold standards. This is based on research. And they help us to move our organizations forward in making sure that we work toward these goals. And it also helps us when we meet with our patients to say, these are the goals recommended by the American Diabetes Association, and we want to help you reach these. I want to thank you so much for joining this webcast. It's been a real pleasure to share this information with you. I will be posting some more resources for you on the resource page, and I'll be updating my slides to make those few corrections so you can utilize those. And I certainly hope you're able to join us at a future webcast. We have a bunch coming up, and it's always makes it so much fun. It's more fun for me to do these live webcasts because I get to, be a part of this community of diabetes educators, and I always appreciate that. So happy 2015, everybody. I'm going to stop recording, but I'm going to stay afterward to answer any questions. Thank you, and this is Beverly Tomasian signing off.